From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, what's it going to be? Your kids' college education or your own nest egg? In light of the recent stock market fluctuations, we talk with financial expert Jane Bryant Quinn about saving and investing. She's recently updated her 1991 guide, Making the Most of Your Money. Also, we meet screenwriter and director Casey Lemons. She's making her directorial debut with the new film Eve's Bayou, starring Samuel L. Jackson. Lemons also wrote the screenplay. And Milo Miles tells us about one of his favorite blues piano players, Willie Maben. His work appears on the new reissue, Chess Blues Piano Greats. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is blasting Iraq's decision to expel American members of a United Nations weapons inspection team from Iraq. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton met with his national security team for 2 hours this morning. The purpose, to decide how to respond to Iraq's latest provocation. After the meeting, the president said he intends to pursue this matter in a very determined way.
Iraq's announcement this morning to expel the Americans from the inspection team is clearly unacceptable and a challenge to the international community.
The president said the United Nations Security Council sent the right message yesterday when it unanimously adopted a resolution that condemned Iraq for failing to cooperate with the weapons inspection teams. Although the resolution wasn't as strong as the U.S. would have liked, it did impose a travel ban on top Iraqi officials. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The State Department is warning Americans not to travel to Pakistan if possible. American diplomats have already told Americans now in Pakistan to stay indoors. Officials say the security situation there in the wake of the murders of four American businessmen has seriously deteriorated. A group is claiming responsibility for the slayings and vows more attacks if Mir Amal Qazi receives the death penalty for his murder conviction. Qazi is the Pakistani man convicted in a U.S. court on Monday of shooting two CIA workers to death 4 years ago. Voters in Miami are casting ballots in a runoff election overshadowed by a deepening investigation into voter fraud. NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
Absentee ballots narrowed the margin between candidates in last week's Miami mayoral election so that a runoff was necessary. But those votes have become the focus of an investigation, prompted by reports that campaign volunteers forged signatures on some absentee forms and bought others. State law enforcement officials have impounded more than 5,200 absentee ballots, and a Dade County grand jury is to examine how it came to be that 11% of all votes in last week's election were cast by absentee ballot. The matter of vote tampering has all but obliterated the discussion of other issues in the runoff between incumbent Miami Mayor Joe Carollo and former Mayor Xavier Suarez. The election had been considered a referendum on the handling of Miami's recent financial crisis and on the candidates' plans to revitalize the city center. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
Senate Democrats are trying to save the nomination of Bill Lan Lee to become the nation's top civil rights enforcer at the Justice Department. Republicans may have enough support in the Senate Judiciary Committee to prevent President Clinton's choice from being voted on by the full Senate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 33 points at 7,434 in active trading. The Nasdaq is up more than 5 at 1547. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is rebounding from yesterday's decline. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner explains.
Investors have been heartened by stability in the stock markets of Hong Kong and Brazil. The market is also being supported by the notion of stable interest rates. In testimony to the House Banking Committee, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said the Asian financial crisis has had a modest impact on the U.S. so far, though he does not expect it to be negligible, adding that export growth will tend to be muted. These comments suggest a moderation in U.S. economic growth and speak of continued low inflation. The day's economic news also argues in favor of stable rates. Worker productivity improved during the third quarter, while unit labor cost fell for the first time since the second quarter of 1994. I'm Doug Krisner.
Discount retailer Kmart says its quarterly earnings for the third quarter of this year are double what they were from the same period a year ago. The company also says it anticipates a solid holiday selling season. It has further extended a voluntary early retirement program for workers. AT&T's president says his company is on the lookout for new partners in the local phone market. But John Zeglis says his company is prepared to work alone. Zeglis, responding to the WorldCom-MCI merger, says AT&T is not afraid of other telecommunication mergers. Shares of biotechnology firm Virus Research Institute lost nearly half their value today after the company said its flu vaccine does not appear to work as well as it did in an earlier study. After the market closed on Wednesday, the company said results from a Phase 2 study showed that the vaccine is inconsistent with its studies in Phase 1. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. The stock market is still reverberating after October 27th's 554-point plunge. There have been steep ups and downs in the last few weeks as investors attempt to take advantage of the market's volatility. Jane Bryant-Quinn says that if you're a smart investor, you should ignore these short-term fluctuations because in the long run, the market is a safe bet. Jane Bryant-Quinn is a syndicated columnist as well as the personal finance columnist for Newsweek magazine and for Good Housekeeping. She has just updated and revised her 1991 book, Making the Most of Your Money. The country's economy and financial picture is changing, buffeted in part by the global marketplace and by new tax codes just enacted by Congress. With all this going on, we invited Jane Bryant-Quinn to join us today to help us to make sense of some of these changes. We began with the stock market, and I asked her how she would describe what happened the last week of October. Was it a crash, a correction, a warning, or irrational exuberance?
Well, we certainly aren't going to call it a crash. I would be happy to call it a warning. You know, we've had nothing but good global news for about 10 years now. You know, lower inflation, lower deficits, freer trade, all kinds of good things have been happening. This is the first reminder that from time to time, bad things happen. And what is going to happen to the United States as a result of this is going to be somewhat slower growth because there are a lot of U.S. companies that do business in with the Asian countries that got in trouble, and Japan is going to hurt because the rest of Asia is hurting, and so a lot of businesses do business in Japan. So they're not going to do as much business. So their profits aren't going to be quite as good as anticipated, and that means that their stocks aren't worth as much. And how much less their stocks are worth is what the market has been trying to figure out. So this isn't just kind of stock market nutso. This is a real economic event that is going to take a little bit of growth off world commerce for a while.
And should we think then globally when we think about the stock market, and certainly there's much more global wheeling and dealing going on, but for the average investor, should they be knowing about what's happening in Southeast Asia or in Europe and thinking about how that might impact their own stocks?
Do you know, it's almost impossible, I think, for the average investor to keep a mind open all the time to all of these different parts of the world. I mean, whoever heard of the ringgit, you know, the Malaysian currency? Whoever heard of the baht, the Thai currency? And who wants to know when you have so many other things on your mind? I think that the way investors need to understand it is, first, obviously we have a global economy that can affect ours. And as a long-term investor, and you should be only a long-term investor, no short-term money should be in the stock market. But as a long-term investor, you need to own some mutual funds that invest in stocks. I'm a mutual fund buyer and a big believer in them. You own U.S., big stocks, small stocks, and you own at least one broadly diversified international fund. And then as an investor, you let the manager of your mutual fund worry about the baht and the ringgit in Japan and Europe and all those other things, because you will have a participation in the long-term events in the rest of the world. And from time to time, it will go down, as it has in Southeast Asia. But most of the time, it will go up, as it does in the United States. We have recessions, but but mostly we have growth. The same is true of the rest of the world. And if you are invested in it that way, you don't really have to think about it on a day-to-day basis.
But does it make sense to look at Europe and to look at European companies as a place to invest as opposed to Asia?
At the moment, I would say that from an economic point of view, the European situation is terrifically positive because I think of Europe as being more or less where the United States was in 1983, 1984, when it was just starting out on what was a very difficult course of downsizing, reengineering, reorganizing to try to get our U.S. companies more set for global competition and also internal U.S. competition. Well, the same process has been starting in Europe the past couple of years as they realize that they have a lot of sclerotic industries. They have to be more prepared for global competition. And also, as they get their common currency together, which is supposed to be coming in 1999, and there's a very good shot that it will, then they are also going to have more internal competition as our country does. So they are going through reengineering, downsizing. It's harder in their political environment, but they're doing it. Hmm. And so let's, if what happens to Europe is what happened to the United States, then you're saying, you know, you have a very good long-term growth story, and that means you have a very good long-term investment story. So maybe the European markets can have the same kind of long bull run that the U.S. market had. As far as Southeast Asia is concerned, you know, those markets are in terrible shape. But, you know, when a market really goes down, I mean, they've had a crash in Southeast Asia. I'm a value investor. I'm interested in markets that mm-hmm. go down. Mm-hmm. So if you have an international mutual fund and you say, okay, you know, I want my guy to be investing in Asia because those stocks are really cheap now. So if I'm going to hold for the long term, that's probably a good bet. And I certainly want to be invested in Europe because there's a long-term growth story there. And so this adds up to a broadly diversified international fund. You know, it's harder to say pick a spot, to pick a country, pick a section of
sure.
the world. But if you just stay diversified, you've got it all.
Well, I wonder, too, when experts and advice columnists tell people to keep things, to hold on to stocks long term. For some people, that might be 3 weeks. For other people, that might be
right.
several generations. What's your definition of long term?
A perfect point. My definition of long term, where I will take the risk, is more than 4 years. Mm-hmm. And for many people, they'll be sort of stunned. They think that's a very long number. But if you look at all of the bear markets since World War II, I asked Ibbotson Associates in Chicago to do this data for me. If you look at the peak of the bull market and then the market drops and drops and drops. It turns around. It comes back up. So it gets back to the point where it started and you reinvest dividends. And I said, how long does it take for a market to recover? And on average, it takes 2 years. The worst market we've had has taken 3.5 years to recover. That was 1972-73 bear market. So if this is money you are absolutely going to need within 4 years, there is a chance that maybe you won't have it. So that's, I sort of draw a 4-year line and say, I'm going to keep my money safe if it's, I absolutely have to have it in 4 years. So if my daughter is 14, that means, and she's going to college, that means I don't want her freshman year money in stocks because there's a risk that maybe the market will go down and won't come back. When she's 15, I don't want her sophomore year money in stocks. So, but if she's 2, I certainly want to have her college money invested in broadly diversified stock-owning mutual funds because there she's got a long time.
Well, I've certainly heard others tout this philosophy of long-term, but they're also best-selling books with another philosophy. And I wonder, too, with the micro-analysis of Wall Street, we get morning reports, we get hourly reports, we get daily reports, whether that really makes it difficult to think long-term because it's like constantly taking your temperature during the day and finding out how you're thinking, how you're feeling.
That's so true. And if I have any message at all, Marty, it is don't do that. This kind of daily looking at stocks, trying to guess, trying to bet, you know, that is long-term a loser's game. This is something the professionals play, and most of them don't beat the market. All of the academic research shows that it is incredibly rare for professional investors to beat the market long-term. And if it's rare for professionals to beat the market long-term, you know, what are you and I going to do when we're bidding against these professionals? And I know people who say, listen, I've owned, you know, these 12 or 15 stocks, and they're fabulous, and they've gone up, and they've beaten the market. And, well, maybe they have beaten the market, but they've beaten the market. The person who has done it has taken a very high risk, and he took a high risk, and he got a high return. But what happens when the market turns down? I'll tell you, I really want to be a long-term investor, and I think that the way to do it is to own well-diversified mutual funds and hold on to them and not take the market temperature every day. I think that's the kind of thing that will lose you money rather than make you money over the long term.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, and then I want to talk some more. And our guest today is Jane Bryant Quinn. She's personal finance columnist for Newsweek magazine, and she has just updated and revised her 1991 book. It's called Making the Most of Your Money. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. Jane Bryant Quinn is my guest today on Fresh Air, and she's the personal finance columnist for Newsweek magazine, and she has just updated and revised her 1991 book. It's called Making the Most of Your Money. I'm thinking about the baby boomers who are now middle-aged, and many of them caught between trying to figure out how to pay for college for their children, how to figure out how to afford their retirement, which is coming probably in 10, 15, 20 years. Under those circumstances, is one more important than the other? Is retirement more important than educating your children?
Retirement is, and that's, I know, going to sound odd to
people.
Ouch, because we all love our children dearly, and our responsibility is to, you know, help them advance and educate them. You know, you have your children, you're responsible for giving them the best start in life. And so, but here is the, so ideally you would have tried to save money for both, but the plain fact is that a lot of people haven't been able to afford to save money for both. And if you cannot save for education and retirement, you have to save for retirement first. And the reason is that, you know, when you retire, that's the only pot of money you're ever going to have. And you may live to 100, and that is it. And it's a very key, I mean, it's key to your personal survival. And your children, very often you find, first, they're a state, wonderful state, you know, colleges and universities that cost less than private schools. So there is a cheaper way to get a good education than going to a private school. And there are student loans that, that the students can take on and the students can pay back. You know, they're 18, 19, 20, 21. They have a lifetime ahead of them in order to try to deal with these costs, whereas you are at the end of your working life and you don't have a lifetime ahead of you to earn more money and deal with these costs. So it's kind of a brutal triage.
Yeah,
but the fact is that is economically the only reasonable way to go. Because what if you spend your whole retirement pot of money on your children's education? Who's going to support you in retirement? You know, maybe your kids would just as soon you kept it, and then they don't have to support you.
Americans are notoriously bad savers. I don't know if we've done any better in the last couple of years or not. You suggest that everybody can set aside 10% of their income for savings. And I'm sure people listening to that are saying, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
my neighbor
right.
can, but I certainly can't. How do you suggest people, I guess, analyze, look at their spending, their income, and try to figure out the pennies that they can put together to find this 10%?
Let me tell you a personal story about this, Marty. Because when you lay out your budget, or as I like to call it, your spending plan, it doesn't sound so serious as a budget, and you try to find that kind of money, it is practically impossible to find. But here's what happened to me when I was much younger and I was a single mother. I had a son and the child support was not forthcoming. Life was not easy. You know, those days when the bills come in and you just don't open them because you know you can't pay them. You know, one of the ways of dealing with a bill you can't pay is not open the envelope.
Of course.
And so I'd been through all of that. And a colleague, I was working for a company, and a colleague said, you know, are you saving any money in the company plan? And I said, are you out of your mind? I can't pay the dentist. And he said, you know, why don't you just try taking 5% out of your paycheck automatically? He said, you'll find that you can do it and things won't change. And I was very skeptical, but, you know, I wasn't making all that much money and 5% wasn't all that much anyway at that time. So I said, okay, I'll try it. And I had 5% deducted automatically and invested. And do you know what happened to my life?
No.
Nothing. Nothing happened. I was living exactly the same way. Life was just as tight. But all of a sudden, I was saving 5%. And I said, this is sort of amazing. I raised it to 7%. And nothing happened. I raised it to 10%. Nothing happened. I couldn't believe it. And I raised it to 12%. I noticed it. I cut it back to 10%. But the thing is that this kind of saving that comes out of your paycheck and you don't even see it, picks up money that slips through your fingers that you don't even know where it's gone. And I'll tell you, I was living very low. And I was still able to do this because I would basically look at what was in the bank, and I would somehow, without having a budget even, I would somehow figure out how to live on what I had there. And I don't know how it works, I don't know why it works, but I know it is magical. And I have encouraged lots of people to do it, as I was encouraged to do it, and they have all said to me, it works.
Interesting. Well, I know that credit card debt rivals, I believe, the federal debt in trillions of dollars.
It's pretty awful, isn't it?
Well, you know, what do you suggest people do with their credit cards? And boy, it seems like every day you get another piece of mail saying, well, we'll give you a credit card and you can have so much money at your fingertips, or you turn on your television and there's that same kind of message. It's awfully tempting to use those easy credit cards because it does make it seem so easy.
That's right, and it makes the banks a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if you borrow too much, the banks could care less, because if you go bankrupt, that is your problem and not the bank's problem. And in fact, they're down in Congress trying to make it harder for you to go bankrupt,
right,
so that they can give you even more credit. I mean, it just really, it makes me very mad, because although certainly we are all responsible for our own credit, at the same time, the bankers have discovered that they can lend a lot of money to people who are basically not credit worthy, and enough of them will repay, so they profit even though a certain percentage of them go broke. And I think that is an incredibly cynical attitude, and I just hate to see the banks doing that.
Yeah, do you suggest that people have one or two credit cards and leave it at that, and that, of course, will keep some kind of control over that easy money?
You bet. I just think all those credit card things that come in the mail, you should do what I do with them. I don't even open them. I don't read the envelopes. I just pitch them out. You don't need a couple of credit cards or absolutely all you need. And if you have one credit card that has a low interest rate, so that's the credit card you would use if you were going to stretch out your purchases. And then you can have one credit card that doesn't matter what the interest rate is, but it has no annual fee. And then you use that card for purchases that you know you're going to pay off by the end of the month. You're in very good shape and you're in good control of your spending. And then I would also encourage you not to increase your credit limits. It's right. Another way of imposing a discipline on yourself. I mean, an 18% credit card, Marty, you are voluntarily adding 18% to the cost of everything you buy. If you went into a store and they said, you know, well, you know, this costs this amount, but we're going to add 18%, would you buy it? No, you turn around and walk away. And then you put it on your credit card and you don't pay it off for a year or 2 years, and you're adding this money without even realizing it.
Well, how do you suggest people then pay down that credit card debt? And again, it can be daunting as some of those percentage points add up.
The worst thing you can do is pay the minimum on your credit card. Most credit cards are set up so that the debt you have right now on your credit card is designed to last for 30 years if you pay only the minimum. And if you add $5, $10, $15, $20, $25 to that a month, you can bring what was a 30-year debt down to maybe a 5-year debt. It is incredible how rapidly credit card debt can diminish. When you start paying considerably or paying even modestly more than the minimum. And the other thing, of course, is to just sort of, I guess, treat it like, that day-by-day sort of step program for, Alcoholics Anonymous and Spendaholics Anonymous and all this other thing. You just say, take it one day at a time and say, I am not going to go any further into debt today. If I want to buy something, I'm going to pay cash. I'm going to use a credit card. I'm going to use a debit card, which is the same as paying cash. I am not going to put down my credit card for something. And you get through one day and then you say, okay, today I am not going to put down my credit card. And you try to control, if your spending is out of control, you try to control the use of your credit card that way.
It sounds like a 12-step program to me that you're describing.
Well, it's like a 12-month program or something. See, I have a friend who said what she did was she took her credit cards and she froze them in the ice tray. And so they were there. But then she said that at Christmas what she did was defrost them. So there's a risk there.
Well, of course, when you're trying to take care of all these bills and debts hanging over your head, it's so easy to feel like you're on a diet or you're deprived or, somehow you're not able to participate in this great American dream.
I know, but then you're not taking control of yourself. You're not taking charge of yourself. Are you a victim or are you in charge? The whole message here is that you know what your income is. You know what your future needs are. You're an intelligent human being. Are you just going to sit back and let all of this drift over you as if you're some kind of a dummy? You don't need to do that. And most Americans, in fact, live in a state of being in charge of their money and their debt and their investments. And sure, we all charge more on our credit cards than we should from time to time. And then we look at the bills and we say, gee, I've charged too much. And then you say, I'm not going to buy things for a while until it's paid off. This is the way most Americans handle their money. Most Americans are, in fact, very responsible. And then the people who aren't doing it just sort of need to take a look at, are they just whining instead of paying attention to how to manage their lives?
Personal finance columnist Jane Bryant-Quinn has just updated her 1991 book, Making the Most of Your Money. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Romance without finance is a nuisance.
But definitely.
Baby, you know I need me some gold. Romance without finance just don't make sense.
It sure don't.
Mama, mama, please give up that gold. You so great and you so fine. You ain't got no money, you can't be mine. It ain't no joke to be stone broke. Baby, you know I ain't lying when I say romance without finance is a nuisance.
You're not kidding, brother.
Please, please, baby, give me some gold.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and Rising Tide Entertainment, featuring Delbert McClinton's new release, One of the Fortunate Few, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with director and screenwriter Casey Lemons about creating the story for her new film, Eve's Bayou, set in a small Louisiana town. It stars Samuel L. Jackson. And critic Milo Miles tells us about a new Chess Records reissue of Blues Piano Players. We're listening to it now.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss, Cohen in for Terry Gross. Casey Lemons is not a stranger to Hollywood. While not a big-name star, she worked as an actress in Silence of the Lambs, Hard Target, Fear of a Black Hat, Drop Squad, and Vampire's Kiss. But when she wrote the screenplay for a film called Eve's Bayou, she knew she had to direct it. The film opened last week and stars Samuel L. Jackson, who is also one of its producers, Lynn Whitfield, Debbie Morgan, Diane Carroll, Vondi Curtis Hall, who is Lemon's husband, and Jurnee Smollett as 10-year-old Eve. It's a lyrical, mystical story about ghosts, memory, family secrets, and a young girl's loss of innocence. In this scene, Eve is having a temper tantrum, which is trying the patience of her aunt and mother.
What did you do to your brother?
I'm going to push him out of a window if I don't get out of this house.
Eve!
Cicely's been in the goddamn bathtub for an hour. You know that? She stayed in there 3 hours yesterday.
Fortunately, there's more than one bathroom in this house.
Ain't that much dirt in all Louisiana. Get out of the damn tub!
You watch your language, young lady.
Mommy keeps stabbing herself in the kitchen. Show her your hands, Mama.
I think you better hush.
And where's Daddy? He's never home. He's supposed to be home sometimes.
Listen, you little ingrate. Your father works hard so we can have a house with four bathrooms.
Not every night he's not working. I know he's not.
Casey Lemons says that she began Eve's Bayou as a novel and that the circumstances in the story are fictional. But Eve Baptiste is 10 in the film, and Casey Lemons was 9 when her parents divorced. I asked her if there was a connection.
There probably is on a level. I mean, I can't say there's not. That would be that would be denial. Yeah, I think there probably is. I think it's something that I looked at later as an adult and said, you know, what was I really feeling? What was I thinking? I was confused, definitely. And it's also talking to other people, other children. You know, of course, many children go through divorces. I think half marriages end up in divorces, and it's pretty common. But it can be kind of confusing for the child. And I definitely think that was partly what I was examining, those feelings.
Do you think
trying to? I mean, Eve really tries to make things right in her own way. She has a sense of justice and a sense of purpose, and it's really about the way the child reacts to the family dissolving.
You got a wonderful performance from the little girl who plays Eve. She's a girl named Jurnee Smollett. Tell us how you found her.
I found her very late in the process. Everyone else had been cast, and I was on location in Louisiana, actually, when I had auditioned many, many wonderful, beautiful little actresses, but I was looking for a raw quality and honesty and a kind of otherworldliness. And I knew that I would find her. We were looking all across the country. I have a brilliant casting director, Jackie Brown, and it was after I went back to Louisiana and was, you know, gearing all up to make the movie, I got the call from Jackie Brown to fly back to L.A. Jurnee just come into town. And I met her, and very quickly, within a few minutes, I knew she was the kid.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, I can remember the second that I knew, and it was halfway through her first scene.
What did she do? What did she say?
It was the way she cried, the rawness of emotion, you know? It made you hurt. It wasn't actory at all. It was raw, like a child in pain, you know, and yet she's a very happy kid. She goes amazingly, facilely between the character and you know, her little kid self, you know. It's so beautiful.
Well, Samuel L. Jackson plays a very important role in this film as Eve's father. And looking at his performance, I can't remember when I saw him play this handsome, sexy, leading role like that.
Well, I think that's why he and his managers were attracted to the material, you know. They're very smart people, and I think they wanted this for Sam for that very reason. And so, you know, I was lucky that he hadn't played a part like that before.
Yeah.
Louis Batiste is a wonderful character to me. I love him because he's so complicated, and he walks that line, you know. He's not a bad guy, and I thought, if we can pull this off, so that this incredibly flawed man comes off sympathetic, you know, you don't hate him. then we've really accomplished something. And Sam totally understood the line that had to be walked and how delicately the character had to be played. And so we talked about it a lot.
What I find so interesting about this film is this young girl's perspective of her family, realizing that there are many complexities, there are many secrets within this family, and there are things that she does that she really doesn't understand. And as a director, it's a challenge to try to tell a story from the slightly confused perspective of a little girl without confusing the audience.
You know, I didn't think about how difficult it was or was going to be, because that's the way the story always was in my mind. It was always from Eve's point of view, so it was not a question of do I write it from a child's point of view and how hard will that be. Visually, you have to be very specific in terms of not being confusing. You have to be very specific when you've got a film that has, you know, flashbacks and ghosts and different points of view and memories. And so we were very specific. Okay, this is a vision, and this is what it looks like. This is a flashback, and this is what it looks like. This is a memory, and this is what it looks like. You know, these are ghosts. but always, I always heard it from Eve's point of view. So I think it's just that important time in your life when you realize that your parents aren't gods. It's a loss of innocence, you know, when you realize that the people around you aren't perfect. And that life is complicated.
Well, I think it's also a sensitive portrayal of a little girl beginning to understand something about adult sexuality.
Right.
And of course, being confused and in many ways angered by it. I mean, Eve sees her father, who does love his family, but he also is a philanderer and is having an affair with a married woman, and she's trying to make sense of this. How did you help this actress understand what was going on in this story?
She had read the script before she auditioned, and I asked her, I said, do you understand the script? And she said, yeah, I went over it with my mother. And so her mother, Janet Smollett, is just an incredible mom. Just a really deep person and a really understanding person who wants the best for her children and yet is in show business, and the whole family's in show business. And I really don't think that Journey could be the actress and the child that she is without such strong parents. But Janet had really talked her through it. In terms visually, you can do tricks. That's the beauty of film. So she didn't actually have to see all the things that Eve sees in the movie. You know, you can shoot around that. But she did understand the script. She did. She had her little child's point of view of mm-hmm. it, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ask Journey what Eve's Bayou is about, she'll give a different answer than you would give.
That's interesting. What does she say?
Well, she'll start by, it's about this girl named Eve. And she, who, you know, loves her family, and she really sees Eve's point of view.
Hmm.
But it's very kind of innocent. It's very innocent and beautiful to hear her talk about it, about the movie, what she thinks it's about. It's very beautiful, actually. The first time I heard her talk about it, I burst into tears.
Oh, really? Do you have a sister?
Yeah, I do. We're very close.
Okay, and the kind of jealousy between Eve and her sister. I mean, they can't live together, but they also can't be apart. You relate to that?
Yeah, we never really had jealousy. The things that I mean, of all the relationships in the movie, that's the one I borrowed the most heavily from my life. It was never really the jealousy, but we read Shakespeare, and my sister read me the complete works of William Shakespeare, and we read it together, and, you know, I always had to play the boys, and she always got to play the beautiful women, Juliet. But we fought very, very hard when we fought, and we were each other's best friend. For, you know, many, many years. We still are. And we're incredibly close. We can feel what each other are thinking. And that was something that I did want to try and put on film.
This film is set in the Bayou, and I know that you were born in St. Louis and lived in Massachusetts. Do you have a kind of connection to the South?
Well, I come from a very, very Southern family. My mother's from Americus, Georgia. My father's from Louisiana and Birmingham, Alabama. They met at Tuskegee Army Air Base. I spent a lot of time at my grandmother's in Tuskegee. So it's not a stretch, you know, to relate to the South for me. In preparation for Eve's Bayou, I spent a lot of time in Louisiana. And also, it's just such a magical place. And It lends itself to a certain type of folklore, and I wanted to tell kind of a difficult story, but in a fairy tale context, and Louisiana is a great place for that.
Well, certainly you have the swamps, you have the Spanish moss, you have the thick forest, the snakes, all that that you can use to tell a story such as this.
It becomes a character in the piece. The location becomes a character.
My guest is Casey Lemons. Her new film, Eve's Bayou, just opened. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Casey Lemons is our guest. She's a writer and director of a new film. It's called Eve's Bayou. Well, I want to ask you about how you were able to get this movie made, and you, having written the film, started to take it to various producers and film companies. You were actually pregnant at the time. This was a first-time feature film for you. You certainly had acted and had written some screenplays in the past, but, you know, how do you get someone to give you money under those conditions, writing a story as complex as this one?
Well, it helps to have Samuel Jackson.
Yeah, right.
And we really got lucky in that we happened upon Trimark at a time when they really were trying to make a movie like this. So everybody else in Hollywood that had passed on the project, which is a normal process, you know, that's the way it's done. Everybody else really didn't need to make Eve's Bayou, and Trimark really did need to make it. And so we ran into them, and it became this marriage of, you know, being in the right place at the right time.
And did you originally want to direct it?
Not originally. Originally, yes. I thought I might direct it one day. When we started shopping it and it became more an immediate prospect, I kind of let go of that and started talking to directors about it or being open to conversations about other directors. And then somewhere along the line, I actually changed my mind again and decided that I was really too close to the material. I woke up one day and I said, no, this just isn't sitting right. You know, somebody's going to mess it up. I mean, Eve's Bayou is complicated and delicately balanced, and I just felt that I was the best person to tell the story. And I'd been to film school, and I wrote the script, so I didn't see why that wouldn't be a good idea. I mean, I could see many reasons why other people might think it wasn't, but I felt pretty strongly.
Do you still want to act? I mean, you act, you write, and now you direct.
Acting is my first love, mm-hmm. and I'll always love it, and I definitely hope to act again.
Well, I don't want to make too much of it, but again, looking at the kind of movies that are get made, I wonder what is offered to a black actress these days.
Well, you know, I have been kind of out of the loop for a couple of years. I've played a lot of, you know, cops, agents, Black Girl Best Friend, Black Girl Next Door,
right.
But I've had a lot of interesting parts. I mean, mm-hmm. I've liked the parts that I've played.
Would you say things are changing in Hollywood, that there's more openness to seeing black actors in a more complex, nuanced role?
Oh, distinctly. I mean, I'm very, very, very encouraged by what's happening in Hollywood. I'm very encouraged by, you know, the success of Soul Food and the fact that Eve's Bayou got made and films that I hear are getting made and directors that are kind of coming up with and behind me. I'm very, very excited about the future. I think that that it's been hard for black actresses. It's hard for any actress, I think. It's hard for women in Hollywood and the more women filmmakers and writers that we have, the better that's going to be. You know, the situation is going to improve by adding talent to the talent pool. A woman's voice is very important. I really believe that. I think that some of the greatest characters ever have been written by men, but I think women are going to really help take it to the next step.
You've been a member of the Writers Guild for about 10 years now. How did you develop your writing talents?
Well, I went to film school, At the time that I went to film school, I was writing scenes for my actors' friends, my actor friends that were in acting school. And, you know, that just kind of got tired of doing David Rabe or Danny in the Deep Blue Sea or, you know, the kind of pieces that everybody does in acting class. And, you know, you see them a lot. And so I started writing scenes for friends of mine that didn't really have a context. It would just be a floating scene. And so that was really my first experience. And then I went to film school. And when I came out of film school, I had made a short film that I was extremely proud of. And I showed it to Mr. Cosby. I had an audition for the Cosby Show. And I said, okay, I'm going to bring in my film, you know. So I auditioned. I didn't get the part. I just said, Mr. Cosby, you know, I'd like to show you this short film that I've made in film school. It's only 7 minutes long. You know, it won't take
long. It won't take up too much of your time, right?
And so he watched it. And afterwards, he said, it's pretty good, kid, you know. But what I really need is a writer. I said, oh, I'm a writer. He said, could you write me a 4-page scene? And that's what I was doing, you know, for fun in my free time. So I said, sure. And he said, bring it back next Tuesday. And I came back on Tuesday. Of course, he'd forgotten he ever talked to me. And he said, you know, who are you? Oh, yeah, come with me. And he showed my scene to a head writer that was working on a film for him that was putting together a team of women. And I wrote as part of a team with Lee Hunkins and P.J. Gibson on a movie that never got made. But that was my first real professional writing experience. And Mr. Cosby got me into the Writers Guild.
What's the hardest part of writing for you?
The solitude. I mean, you get very lonely. and just getting through it. I mean, I do a lot of procrastinating. You know, I clean the house. I make lunch, you know, twice.
Anything but writing, right?
you know, talk on the phone. It's hard discipline. And it's lonely. I get lonely. You know, sometimes, you know, my friends call and they want me to come out. And it's like, no, I'm working. And, you know, it's great when they can finally see a finished product and say, oh, that's what you've been doing all those times you couldn't go out with us.
Well, I'm thinking about the year that you, or the year and a half, I guess, that you and your husband, Vondi Curtis Hall, have had. You both debuted a feature-length film. You managed to have a baby in the middle somewhere there. How have you survived these last 18 months?
Actually, I haven't, you know, I try not to think about it too. I couldn't have gotten through it if I had overthought about it too much. I mean, one thing that happened was, you know, Vondi wrote his film after I wrote Eve's Bayou, and we both started shopping them, and then his looked hot, and then something would fall through, and then mine would look hot, but then it wouldn't come through. And so we didn't actually know when they were going to land, like how it was going to go for us. You never really know when you're going to get your green light. And so at the same time, we're trying to have a baby, and so we decided, well, let's just have the baby, you know? And both films got greenlit. So it's kind of one of those situations that I don't think we would have exactly planned it that way. But that's the way it worked out. So I directed my movie with a 3-month-old baby. He was 3.5 months or 4 months when we started and 7 months when we finished. And
wow, how do you do that?
Well, you have great backup support. You have a great nanny. He was on the set the entire time. Everybody loved Hunter, and I think it's really affected his personality in a positive way, you know, because he's a very social baby, and he's a very confident baby because, you know, every time he came to work, 150 people were glad to see him, you know, Hunter! I've got tons of pictures of different actors kissing my baby, Branford Marcellus holding the baby up in the air. And so I think it was kind of a wonderful experience for the little guy, you know. On the other hand, it was very painful for me at times. But I held him a lot. I usually held him at the monitor through the rehearsal, and then right before we would go to action, I would you know, kind of give him up temporarily, you know, to the nanny, and just so that, you know, there wasn't a noise factor. But I actually directed many shots holding him.
Really, on your hip or over your shoulder? Or?
Holding him in my lap at the monitor. My parents were around a lot, and they saved my life. And so that was wonderful. And, of course, having Vondi in the movie helped because, you know, he was around.
Do you have another film you're working on?
Right now I'm writing a script with my husband that's for him to direct, and that's really what I'm working on. I'm talking to a lot of people about a lot of projects, and yet, on the other hand, I'm biding my time. I feel it's important to me as an artist to wait to feel extremely passionately about something, because making movies is extremely difficult, and it takes, you know, it's a year out of your life or more that's wonderful, but also very painful. And, you know, you go through a whole range of emotions and it's exhausting. And I need to feel extremely passionately before I involve myself in another project. Maybe that's because I'm a woman, or maybe it's because I'm a mommy, you know, but I'm waiting to feel the passion.
Well, Casey Lemons, thank you so much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Casey Lemons' new film is Eve's Bayou, which she wrote and directed. It stars Samuel L. Jackson. This is Fresh Air. Although famous for its blues, Chess Records of Chicago was not known for its blues pianists. Guitars, especially roaring electric guitars, became the company's trademark. Eddie Boyd and Willie Maben were blues pianists and recorded for Chess back in the 50s. Music critic Milo Miles has been waiting for Chess to reissue their records. Now it has, in a CD called Chess Blues Piano Greats.
My baby's picture in the frame is all I see since she's been gone. My picture in the frame.
Willie Maben was all powerful in his delightful number, The Seventh Son, but he had no clout at Chess Records. He and Eddie Boyd were unusually dissatisfied in their business relations with the Chess Brothers. And they would certainly be disappointed at how hard it's been to buy their best sides for so many years. Casual blues listeners may want to look for anthologies with selected hits by Maben and Boyd, but the double CD reissue Chess Blues Piano Greats finally puts things right for the serious blues hound. It's a spiffy package and a good deal. While Chess Piano Blues Greats includes only a few dandy sides by the masterful Otis Spahn and Lafayette Leake, the highlight of the set is the intriguing study in contrast between Boyd and Maben.
Love my baby, but my baby don't love me. Love my baby, but my baby don't love me. She said, Daddy, you've given me the third degree. She said, Daddy, Daddy, why did you stay out so long? She said, Daddy, Daddy, why did you stay out so long? She said, you knows, pretty baby, you should have brought it on home.
Boyd's blues were generally depressive, even downright scary paranoid on a tune like Third Degree. He remained a fairly crude pianist, but he sang and wrote songs in obvious spasms of emotion. These included rowdy, drunken snarls like Hard Time Getting Started, and some cheerful romps like Rosalie Swing. But Boyd had little of the Delta Country hoodoo menace of Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf, and he liked to record with horns, something else not heard often on Chess releases. Boyd never found the right niche until he moved to Finland in 1971. He died there, satisfied in a star, in 1994. Willie Maben, on the other hand, belonged to a distinct group of stylists. namely urbane wise guy pianists in the manner of Charles Brown and Amos Milburn. Problem was, Mabin was making sides for Chess, who preferred their hoochie-coochie men brawny and blunt. Still, Mabin's deadpan boasts and complaints are as precise and hilarious as any in the business, particularly in hits like I Don't Know and the even more corrosive follow-up I'm Mad.
I've got the blues.
Again, like Charles Brown, Mabin had a fondness for hushed, late-night lounge blues. This is the sort of stuff that Philip Marlowe might have looked for on the jukebox in those L.A. dives. You can put on Chess Blues piano greats and join him.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. Chess Blues Piano Greats is on Chess MCA Records.
I'm mad. I'm mad. Man, and you have the nerve to try to be glad. I'm mad.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen. This week, Henny Youngman celebrates his 70 years in showbiz. We'll close the show with this 1978 bit.
Downtown, I said to a lady, you know where Michigan Avenue is? She says, yeah. And she walked away. One fellow said, give me $10 till payday. I said, when is payday? He said, you ought to know. You're the one that's working. One fellow said, I haven't eaten in 2 days. I said, you should force yourself. One fellow said, I haven't tasted food all week. I said, don't worry, it tastes the same. One guy says, give me $300 for a cup of coffee. I said, coffee's a quarter. I want to drink in Brazil. Give these fellas money, they gamble. One fellow said, I played a great horse the other day. Took 7 horses to beat him. I played a horse so slow, the jockey kept a diary of the trip. The jockey hit the horse. Horse turned around and said, what are you hitting me for? There's nobody behind us.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye, 5 Fairy Stories by A.S. Byatt. This is NPR, National Public Radio.